Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 226 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, Anne Morgan retells the grand old myth about becoming a published author and takes her editorial red pen to all of its inaccuracies. Following Anne, Nicholas Murray dissects his own reluctance to call himself a writer after an early career in journalism and despite having subsequently published more than 20 books in a huge variety and fusion of genres. First, here's Anne Morgan with Rewriting the Publishing Fairy Tale.
There is a myth about the business of being an author. It goes something like this. Once upon a time, there was a little girl who wanted to be a writer. So she worked very hard, scribbling lots of stories. Years passed, and still the little girl, who was now a woman, wrote her stories. Then, one day, a fairy god agent popped up and promised to make all her dreams come true. The fairy god agent waved her wand and sent the young woman off to the book fairy ball, where a handsome publisher prince whisked her off her feet with a 3-book deal, and they all lived happily ever after. This is the fairy tale ending to which many aspiring writers cling. For a large proportion of the hundreds of thousands of people who participate in National Novel Writing Month each year and sign up for creative writing courses, and for the millions more who will corner you at a party to tell you that they've always wanted to write a book, this is the dream that keeps them going. Bolstered by a slew of articles on getting an agent and novel editing guides, the popular perception boils down to this. If you manage to gain entrance into the rarefied world of the published writer, your struggles will be over. It was certainly what I believed when I got my first book deal. Indeed, when it happened, it seemed to have more than a little fairy tale magic about it. Having spent my 20s working part-time and getting up early in order to devote as much time as possible to plugging away at usually not very promising novel drafts, I stumbled on an idea for a non-fiction book when a blog I had started became popular. All of a sudden, doors that I had been knocking on for years seemed to fly open. After I signed with my agent, who contacted me when she heard about the idea, we had an offer on the table half an hour after she sent out the proposal. I felt like the goose that had laid the golden egg. An idea that I had hatched in my living room had inspired a publisher to stump up an advance for a book that did not even exist. Surely this was the start of a charmed life. 6 years into living my happily ever after, I smile back on the way I saw things then. From my own experiences and the stories of numerous writers I've encountered personally and through books, I have learned that rather than being the satisfying end of a quest, for most authors, that first book deal marks the start of a career that will have peaks and troughs and plenty of rejection along the way. The belle of the ball can find herself an auction the week before her book launch when her editor changes jobs, while budget cuts can leave last season's beautiful swan feeling like the ugly duckling. And as for the goose that laid the golden egg, well, we all know what happened to that. The publishing fairy tale persists, however, largely because many of the inside stories of the industry are rarely told. There's a good reason for this. In a relatively small and competitive market that is frequently driven by relationships, few writers want to risk biting the hand they hope will feed them by airing their gripes. Indeed, there's usually little point. Though they may sting at the time, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune that almost every writer suffers at some point in their career are rarely personal. By and large, they have more to do with columns of numbers than with words written by an author or anyone else. This can be small comfort when you're staring down the barrel of a harsh rejection, a cutting review or a creative dry spell, however. At such times, the publishing fairy tale often seems to shimmer brightly, a happy ending liberally accorded to all the writers seeing their books longlisted for illustrious prizes and feted in review sections, yet cruelly denied to you. The thought is hardly encouraging. Perhaps then, as we are in the business of playing with words, We could all benefit from taking a red pen to that tantalising, pernicious, happily ever after myth and rewriting it a little. Maybe it would do us all good to spend a bit of time rummaging in the genre dressing up box and seeing what other costumes we can find that might better fit that odd, awkward being, the writing life. What about horror? Melodramatic though it may sound, I'm sure many writers have known that sickening sense of fear and shock when you come face to face with the monstrous possibility that everything you've worked so hard to build may be torn apart in one fell swoop, often through no fault of your own. Spare a thought for Herman Melville, who had to watch his work savaged by UK critics after the British edition of Moby Dick was published without the epilogue that explains Ishmael's survival and makes sense of the book. Put yourself in Salman Rushdie's shoes when he witnessed heaps of copies of his fourth novel, The Satanic Verses, burnt in the street and had to go into hiding after a fatwa was declared against him. Even more humdrum setbacks can feel like the stuff of nightmares when you're obliged to live through them. I know of writers dumped by their agents by post, novelists forced to reinvent themselves and go incognito after disappointing sales, and an author whose publisher emailed 4 months after she had had a baby to say that her next book was, and I quote, almost meaningless. At such times, humour is often the only response. Indeed, just as horror can tip over into comedy if it's laid on too thick, so those of us trudging along the darkest stretches of the writing path can sometimes have the feeling that we are trapped inside a grim farce. I certainly had this impression when I was living through a submissions process during which my agent forwarded every rejection she received to me with the subject line, Anne Morgan. It got so that I came to dread seeing my name in my inbox. I had, literally, become my own worst enemy. When I started the hashtag #BestBadReview on Twitter last year and invited writers to share their favourite hatchet jobs, I received numerous responses from authors seeing the funny side of less than ideal situations. Highlights included, I find it difficult to reconcile the sweet face of the author on the back jacket with the foul language within, for Anne H. Putnam's memoir, Navel Gazing, and an intriguing response to one of Jenny Colgan's novels. I threw this stupid book over a wall! In a similar vein, I had to admire the good humour of a friend who, having waited a year to receive any kind of response to one of his manuscripts, sent a birthday card to the person sitting on it to mark the anniversary of the date he'd sent it in. Of course, when a run of bad luck persists and when critics, editors or readers are consistently unreceptive or unkind, it can be hard to keep smiling. Literary history is filled with stories of writers who went to their graves ignorant of the recognition and admiration their work would one day receive. The fate of the queen of the psychological novel, Shirley Jackson, who was dismissed as a writer of trash in her time and dubbed Virginia Werewolf by some critics because of her interest in the occult, and who died a lonely and squalid death after years of agoraphobia, fills me with sadness. And oh, how I wish Emily Bronte could have known when she died the year after Wuthering Heights was published that her only novel would go on to be held up as one of the great classics of world literature. There is a towering tragic quality to such stories. Indeed, when in the throes of one of the many struggles the writing life involves, it can be tempting to identify with the heroes of classical antiquity and see yourself as the victim of cruel gods and fickle fate. I'm like Sisyphus! I'm like Sisyphus! I remember shouting down the phone to my agent when I discovered that a publisher wanted a rewrite of one of my books. I must have sounded ridiculous. Truth be told, the only thing I probably shared with the heroes of the ancient Greek legends was hubris. Still, it didn't feel like that at the time. When you live with a project intensely, as books often require, it can become your universe. And when something jeopardises it, it can feel like the end of the world. Certainly, although comparisons to mythology and high tragedy may be extreme, the unfortunate coincidences and twists of fate that often stymie writing projects can make it feel as though being an author involves living, at least part of the time, on Tessa de D'Urberville's blighted star. Hardy may well have agreed. Not only did he struggle for years to get into print, but he was obliged to rewrite passages in several of his books to pander to Victorian prudishness, and finally abandoned the novel form altogether, Jude the Obscure having received outraged reviews. A blighted star, however, is not a very encouraging image to go forward with into future writing projects. Perhaps, then, it makes sense to abandon literary genres altogether and reach into another section of the library to find a narrative that provides an accurate and livable reflection of the reality of being a writer. Economics may help here. I'm thinking not of the depressing figures about the health of the book industry that come out with alarming frequency, but rather of the planning fallacy proposed by Nobel Prize winner Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky, which Kahneman expounds in his book Thinking Fast and Slow. It revolves around the idea that human beings almost always underestimate the time, effort, money, and risk their projects will involve. This blind spot inevitably leads to wasted resources and many failed ventures, but it might also have its uses in that it encourages us to attempt things we might never try if we had an accurate grasp of our chances of success. To me, this sounds a lot like the writing process. When I sit alone in my study, scrabbling out a first draft, I can often be wildly optimistic about how quickly a book will come together. I forget the laborious redrafting and editing previous projects have gone through, not to mention the graveyard of half-finished things littering my hard drive and desk drawers. And I barely give a thought to what will happen once the manuscript passes from my hands and out into the wider world. Of course, with so many factors beyond my control and so many other people involved in bringing a story to the bookshop shelves, it's almost inevitable that something will go wrong somewhere along the way. Really, when you think about the scope for error in the process, it's a miracle that anything makes it into print at all. Instead of lamenting our setbacks, perhaps we writers would do better to marvel at the rare occasions where everything goes well. Such pragmatism is not romantic. It's a long way from the rags-to-riches tale of the debut author rocketed to overnight success. Ultimately, however, for those of us hoping to make a lengthy career out of putting words on the page, the planning fallacy can be a useful lens through which to look at writing and publishing now and again. It shows up the cracks and the flaws, and helps us see that the knocks, injustices and bad luck we suffer are not unique punishments reserved for us alone, but rather the inevitable consequences of a far from perfect process. This is not the fairy tale ending we might have hoped for when we laboured away over our first manuscript. But who wants to live happily ever after, anyway?
That was Anne Morgan. You can find out more about Anne on her website at www.annemorgan.me. That's Anne, spelled A-N-N. Next, here's Nicholas Murray with Are You a Writer?
Sitting recently in a small cafe in Athens, in the Plaka district, sipping from a tiny white cup of coffee, I looked up and saw that the painted wooden sign above the heads of the two old gentlemen opposite me read, The Old Man of the Morea. The name given to the colourful general of the Greek War of Independence, Theodoros Kolokotronis. Shortly before leaving on my trip, I had read Nikos Kazantzakis' account of his travels in Greece, written originally as a set of newspaper articles in the 1930s. And in his chapter on Kolokotronis, the author of Zorba the Greek describes the 19th century warrior's life as, I quote, a dramatic, characteristic unfolding of a rich modern Greek soul, faith, optimism, tenacity, valour, a certain practical mind, deceptive versatility, like Odysseus. A very characteristic Kazantzakis sentence. The two men smiled benignly and asked me first where I was from and then what I did for a living. Years ago I learned the Greek word for writer, syngrapheas, and so was able to answer their question in Greek. They nodded approvingly and asked what kind of books I wrote. Histories? Realising that my command of modern Greek was already reaching its outer limits, I nodded. It seemed the easiest way of answering that question. But even when I am at home speaking in English, this is a question I find myself responding to uncertainly, even shiftily, never sure quite what to say. As writers, we are often the prisoner of the terms of genre, a kind of pigeonholing that we kick against. Yet, I have even kicked against the broad term itself, writer. 25 years after my first book was published, I'm still not sure what to call myself. Before that first book, published when I was just 40, I used to call myself by another word, journalist. In Greek, dimosiographos, which I suppose you could translate literally as public writer. I seemed reasonably happy with this. It described what I did for a living. I was a member of the National Union of Journalists. I wrote articles for unglamorous trade magazines. My literary persona was still waiting to emerge fully with that first book, which was followed by such a breathless race to catch up that today, if I swell the bibliography with all those pamphlets, I have notched up 23 international standard book numbers. I think I am entitled to call myself a writer. So why the hesitation? Why the faltering tone? I suppose I have to say that while always wanting to write, I never recall saying, I want to be a writer. Did I think it pretentious, presumptuous? I'm not sure I can put my finger on it exactly, but somehow I want to decline the status of writer. I want to shift attention to my books, my words, the tangible products of the writer's craft. I say this in the face of what sometimes feels like intolerable pressures on writers now to be writers, to play the part, to strut on the literary stage, to sell themselves as much as their books. But I realise that I cannot say this is new. When I was writing my biography of Aldous Huxley, I turned up in my research many magazine profiles of the 1920s and 1930s for which the writer had to make himself available. Often playing up to it, foppish, epigrammatic, an angular old Etonian Oscar Wilde. In the 19th century, Dickens, Trollope, and, yes, Oscar Wilde went on extravagant tours of America, flaunting themselves as writers, personalities, phenomena. I have always cherished that acid put down by the literary critic F.R. Leavis of the Sitwells. They belong to the history of publicity, not poetry. The Sitwells would have been unfazed. But it's a little late now to complain of this. Writers' contracts with publishers increasingly state that the author must be available for publicity tours, bookshop signings, festival appearances, and other promotional activity. Many writers enjoy these events, making contact with readers as real people rather than abstractions, getting out of the isolation of their writing rooms. Writers like J.D. Salinger, who are recluses, are very rare these days. Though when I saw Don DeLillo on stage at the Hay Festival some years ago, I thought he looked uncomfortable. Not normally given to these sorts of exposure, he responded courteously to Jim Nocte's resourceful questioning, but made me feel that this was not a happy excursion for him, and one that served little purpose, either for him or for us, his readers. My difficulty with those old men of the Plaka was not, however, a fear of exposure, of self-advertisement. It was rather a difficulty about definition, about which pigeonhole to place myself in. I have written in many genres, poetry, fiction, travel, biography, essay, political polemic, autobiography, topography, cultural criticism. Often I have written in combinations of these, mixing travel and personal reminiscence, for example, or politics and poetry, or fiction and autobiography. I like writing which promiscuously plays with multiple genres. I like digression, going off at a tangent, mixing it. The problem with literary genres and classifications, so popular with librarians and booksellers, is that they can be limiting, forcing us into moulds, down narrow alleyways we don't really want to venture into. One of my early books was called A Short Book About Love. A plain enough title, you might think. But what exactly was it? It's not a novel, was the reported comment from a friend of the person I had given a copy to. Was this intended as a criticism? I didn't take it as such. It certainly contained fictional elements, some properly fictive in the sense of being purely invented, others lightly disguised autobiography. Some passages reflecting on the various kinds of love were more like essays, even literary criticism. And binding this all together was a retelling in a generally light-hearted style of the medieval legend of Tristan and Isoude. It didn't stop there, for threaded into this variegated texture was my attempt, indirect, exploratory, tentative, to say something about the recent death of my father, which may have been the immediate trigger for writing the book, though not its declared subject. I'm happy to say it wasn't a novel in the conventional sense, and if pressed, I suppose I would settle for fiction. But in truth, I wasn't perturbed by its failure to follow the expected rules of one or other genre. I just wanted people to pick it up, read it, and enjoy the variety, the multifaceted quality, the unexpectedness. Just as contemporary composers of classical music expect us to listen with open ears, without the presumption that their new work will necessarily sound like Haydn, wanting us to enjoy the new and possibly unexpected sounds that their musicians deliver, so I think a book should be granted the permission to speak on its own terms, to ask politely for a hearing, even if the accent is surprising or initially odd. Wordsworth said that the poet must create the taste by which he is understood, which I take to be not an arrogant imposition of something alien to the reader, a deliberate flouting of expectation, but an invitation to try something different, to give it the benefit of the doubt, to let it work on you. There is no compulsion here. No one is obliged to read, listen to, look at anything they genuinely don't like. But until one has tried something, one will never know whether or not it could be to one's taste. In a more recent book, published in 2016, Crossings, A Journey Through Borders, I explored the idea of borders, literal and metaphorical. It contained very straightforward accounts of border crossings around the world, as well as reflections on the meaning of borders. It meditated on borders of class, culture, even the border between life and death. One reviewer described it as a collection of essays on the theme, which, if it would help the people who have the task of finding it in the right place, I can live with, though I perhaps saw it as a more integrated patterning, if not a seamless garment, then one that seemed to be woven from the same material. Some of the most successful and original contemporary authors, like the late W.G. Sebald or, in a lighter vein, Jeff Dyer, have produced books which one would struggle to assign to a definite watertight category. Yet they are none the worse for that. The human mind is various, venturesome, playful, exploratory, curious, unpredictable, drawn to chance associations, unexpected connections, as much as it is insistent on always getting what it thought it wanted to begin with. Creativity is just that, making it new and different, following the imagination's spontaneous promptings, letting go. Am I saying, therefore, that genre is a nuisance, an encumbrance, something we need to escape from? A straitjacket? I don't think so. There are pleasures to be had from genre, from seeing its disciplines and skills at work. A well-constructed novel with a beginning, a middle and an end, a tightly crafted play, a suspenseful thriller, an informative cradle-to-grave biography, are all admirable and give pleasure. If there are no rules, then there are no rules against rules, and, working within certain formal constraints and expectations, is itself pleasurable, satisfying for the reader as well as the writer. I've used the word pleasure twice in succession, and this may be the key to my aesthetic of hedonism. Write what you want, read what you want, enjoy whatever comes your way, would be my permissive mantra. Don't box yourself in. Feel free to experience whatever you want to experience. But there is more to the concept of genre than this. It should not be seen as a necessary constraint on creative freedom. The poet Robert Frost famously said that free verse was like playing tennis with the net down. T.S. Eliot, however, argued that the best free verse was always shadowed by the formal verse it seemed to be repudiating, that there was, in fact, no such thing as free verse, poetry being an art that demands its own exacting discipline, letting it all hang out not being the prescription for good poetry. I tend to agree, and would add that formal constraints in poetry are not in any sense a curb on creativity. On the contrary, they can be an opportunity. Using regular forms, or to borrow a term used by the poet A. E. Stallings, who writes almost exclusively in regular meters, received forms, involves responding to a creative challenge that can yield fine results, testing oneself against the demands of form, trying to overcome what could look like constraints, can be a source of invention and creative excitement. One of the great formal resources of poetry is rhyme. Often mistakenly thought to have gone out of fashion, except in hip-hop, it is in fact very much a living feature of contemporary poetry, though not every poet uses it to the same extent or with the same frequency. It answers to a need to create formal patterns in verse. It is not just a matter of following some rigid rule of matching sounds. It is intimately involved in the structure of sense in a poem, the reinforcement of meaning. Rhyme is found in various metrical forms that are still very much in use. I recently published the third of a series of poetic satires, written in very tight, regular prosodic forms. It was a pamphlet-length political satire called A Dog's Brexit. As the title suggests, it's a hard-hitting Swiftian satire on the present political situation. But it uses a very strict form, known in the poetic trade as the standard happy. This derives from a famous 18th century lament for a Scottish piper called Happy Hamilton that first used this verse form, but it was quickly taken up by Robert Burns and is sometimes known as the Burns stanza or the Scottish stanza. First used in a serious elegy, it became increasingly the vehicle of satire and was revived in the 1980s by poets such as John Fuller, James Fenton and Clive James. I used a slightly altered version of the Burns stanza, as modified by W.H. Auden, which essentially adds an extra line to the stanza. And I have to say that, apparently very strenuous as it is in its formal demands, it is great fun to handle, and I hope, for the reader or listener, great fun to hear. Rather than prolong this prosodic lecture, let me offer you a short extract. All you need to know here is that the speaker of the poem is a dog. Who'd be a dog in England now? They patronise my suffering brow with soft caress. Sometimes I snatch my bone and race into some dark secluded place, unable to remain at home and face this rottenness. Let me, a hound with drooping ears, dissent from all that yapping rabblement of loud MPs, so that a calmer canine view prevails above the shrill discordant wails of members as each tries and fails to please. Which part of exit did you miss? Constituency parties hiss at those too frightened to assert that cutting loose will hurt more than it heals, as every Jacques and Kurt well knows. A noxious vapour reaches overseas, borne on a toxic xenophobic breeze of hate, and friends abroad, whose own far right grows eager for a matching fight, predict a European night too late. It would certainly have been possible to have written a poem on this theme that declined to make use of any formal properties, rhymes, received metrical forms, but I have a feeling that it would have been less entertaining. Political poetry always runs the risk of turning into a rant, and although, actually, this is a bit of a rant, as you can plainly see, and I wanted it to be so, it can be enjoyed, and I have found this in a couple of performances I have given of it, by listeners or readers who are less exercised than I am by its subject matter. I have made clear that for me the pleasure principle is central in any art form, and if the formal resources of poetry, the demands and opportunities of this or that formal or generic discipline give pleasure, add to the fun, then let us embrace them. To return to my two elderly Athenians in the shady cafe on the slopes of the Acropolis, what would I have told them had my Greek been up to the challenge? I think I would have said that we write in the end what we want to write, what works for us, what something deep inside ourselves seems to prompt us to write. This can involve gladly embracing the opportunities and stimulus provided by the rules of a particular genre, or it can mean breaking free and experimenting, or choosing any point along that spectrum. There are no rules for the novel, Aldous Huxley once said. It only has to be interesting. And if one has written something interesting, and the reader finds it interesting, then what more could one wish for? So I will tell them that I have written some books, very different from each other, and they must feel free to choose, adding that only one has actually been translated into Greek.
That was Nicholas Murray. You can find out more about Nicholas on his website at www.nicholasmurray.co.uk. And that concludes episode 226, which was recorded by Carolyn Sanderson and Julia Kopus and produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 227, Lucy Moore speaks with James McConaughey about recovering the life of a Civil War aristocrat from her receipt book, the roots of chemistry in the housewife's distilling room, and the contrasting attitudes of Puritans and Royalists to the role of women in society. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.